Hello there. Today is Wednesday, June 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Attorney General says he did nothing improper in meeting with Russia's ambassador to Washington.
I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States.
A U.S. college student medically evacuated back to the U.S. from a North Korean prison. The growing impact of fake news in the age of digital information. Also ahead, an American actress has a big scare in the air. It's all on today's International Edition. A U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said Tuesday that any suggestion he colluded with Russia to meddle in last year's presidential election is, quote, an appalling and detestable lie. Sessions answered questions for more than 2 hours in an open session Tuesday with the Senate Intelligence Committee. That's the panel investigating Russian interference in the November vote.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign.
He told the committee there was nothing improper when he met twice last year with Russia's U.S. ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. He said both meetings were in his capacity as a U.S. senator and not part of the Trump campaign.
At all times throughout the course of the campaign, the confirmation process, and since becoming Attorney General, I have dedicated myself to the highest standards. I've earned a reputation for that. At home and in this body, I believe, over decades of performance. The people of this country expect an honest and transparent government, and that's what we're giving them.
Well, joining me now for some perspective is attorney and political analyst James Goodnow. James, what was your overall impression of the hearing?
My overall take is that Jeff Sessions acted as a classic lawyer. He engaged in a lot of tap dancing. He was squirrely at times and a little bit slippery. And there are some legitimate reasons for the answers he gave, but there were others that really had no foundation in the law or in any other doctrine for not answering. So I think people who were looking for bombshells are probably feeling largely unsatisfied. And if anything, this just raises more questions about what happened in this firing of Jim Comey.
Why did it raise more questions?
Because he wasn't direct and he didn't answer those questions. So people will naturally ask, well, why not? Do you have a good reason for it? Now, we know that Jeff Sessions cited a number of legal doctrines. As an example, he said he's relying on appropriateness, which, by the way, is not a legal doctrine. He said he was basing his decision not to answer on long-standing principles. Well, again, that's not a legal basis for refusing to answer a question. He cited the confidentiality. Well, that's a real legal doctrine. It doesn't apply when you're testifying in front of Congress here. So people were confused, I think. The senators clearly asking the questions, the Democrats in particular, were upset. I think probably observers and lawyers watching this realized that those weren't legal doctrines. There really was no reason for Jeff Sessions not to answer these questions. And that's, I think, why many people are feeling, but there's something more there. Let's get some answers to these questions.
What were the questions that he wasn't answering?
There were a number of them. I would start with the subject of the firing of Jim Comey. Specifically, was the Rod Rosenstein letter, so this was the letter authored by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein outlining the basis for Jim Comey's termination, or at least the proffered basis for his termination, was that a pretext? That is the question I think the senators wanted answered and, frankly, the public. And what we heard from Jeff Sessions was, well, one, I'm not going to discuss any of my conversations with Donald Trump about that. So right there, that is the big issue that was taken off the table right out of the gates. To me, the big issue here was that obstruction? What was Donald Trump thinking about? And Jeff Sessions said, basically, I ain't going to tell you. Second, that Oval Office meeting, we go back to the Valentine's Day meeting where Jeff Sessions was in the Oval Office with Jim Comey. We know Jared Kushner was there as well. And Jim Comey testified last Thursday. Thursday that President Trump dismissed everyone. I think it's significant that Jeff Sessions confirmed that he, quote, departed from the Oval Office, but he didn't give any more details about the circumstances of that. I think it's fair to look at the subtext there and say Donald Trump probably said something, but we didn't get clarity on that.
And there was a lot of question about the firing of FBI Director James Comey, who was conducting the Russia investigation, which Jeff Sessions was supposedly a part of that firing, but he had recused himself from being a part of the investigation. How did he answer that?
I really thought this was, frankly, the worst moment for Jeff Sessions in all of his testimony. He said rather indignantly, well, yes, I may have stepped aside for the Russian probe, but of course it would be absurd to think that I wouldn't be involved in the oversight function I have of the FBI. And he offered no real support for that. So simply asserting that it's absurd does not answer the question. And I don't think it really comports with the understanding of recusal that most people have, that senators have, or that lawyers have. It really seems to be Jeff Sessions' own definition of recusal that he's created. So to me, he was weak on this point, and he didn't offer any clarity about why he did it or what his role would be going forward.
So where do we go from here?
One of the challenges with testimony in front of the Congress is if you don't answer the questions, there is very little that the Congress, Senate specifically here, can do about it. So I think it could be that nothing comes of this. Jeff Sessions could be questioned again. There were some references to doing it in a closed session, but Jeff Sessions said, well, I probably won't give you any more answers there either. So I think for anyone who is concerned about what's happening, or for Democrats or progressives that are trying to move forward to get more answers, it may be that they don't get any. And I think that will be a large frustration that we're going to see play out publicly over the coming months.
Do you think the president would be pleased with the way Sessions conducted himself in the hearing?
Yeah, I do. I think Jeff Sessions has been a loyal soldier for Donald Trump from the beginning, and I think he proved that he would do that again here, and he did, in fact, do that. He really didn't say anything that was hugely damaging to Donald Trump. I think if I'm watching this in the White House and I'm Donald Trump, he probably says, okay, this guy is still with me. So I think here, to the extent he was trying to continue to be an ally or a defender of Donald Trump, he largely succeeded.
All right, Attorney James Goodnow, we always appreciate your perspective. Thanks for your time. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's the word on social media?
So two stories that we've talked about in some regard in the past week or two might sound familiar to our listeners, but these are new takes on these old stories. The first is a congressional hearing that happened on Tuesday, the Sessions hearing. Attorney General Jeff Sessions appearing on Capitol Hill to talk about the Trump campaign's links to Russia. Now, this tracks very similarly on social media to the Comey hearing that we talked about extensively last week with former FBI Director James Comey testifying on the Hill. So you have the same kind of hashtags. You had hashtag Comey hearing. Now you have hashtag Sessions hearing. You have a lot of the same senators who are trending because they've asked very pointed questions, specifically Senator Kamala Harris from California going into prosecutorial mode, former prosecutor asking some very pointed questions. And then we'll begin to see some of the memes and some of the key moments. Those usually take about a day or so to develop, but I wouldn't be surprised if out of this hearing we see some lines that get a particular attention, as we did with the Comey hearing, when former FBI Director James Comey said, Lordy, I wish there were tapes of his conversations with President Trump. That word Lordy getting a lot of attention.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we see some of that from Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
All right. And what else is going on?
And another story we've talked about extensively on the show, the link between hate speech and terrorism activity and social media. A lot of governments pushing social media companies to cut down on those activities and monitor them. And on Tuesday, we saw French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Theresa May meeting and talking about how those two countries, France and the UK, are going to partner together to try to hold social media companies accountable, particularly going to fine social media companies or going to consider fining social media companies if they don't crack down on this hate speech. Now, I've talked about this on the show before. In the European Union, there have been rules and regulations in place to help social media companies crack down on this, to encourage them and even hold their feet to the fire, fining them. And now we're seeing this from France and the UK. perhaps not surprising that this is coming out now, just a few weeks after the Manchester attacks. After those attacks, Theresa May said that social media needed to be something that maybe not surprising, coming just a few weeks after the Manchester attacks. After those attacks, Prime Minister Theresa May said that social media companies really needed to take a bigger role in cracking down on hate speech and terrorism activity. So now we're seeing some of that words in action. Remains to be seen whether or not the social media companies will face these monetary fines and how the governments are actually going to hold them to this. But the big number that we're seeing, 50 million euros, that's the maximum amount of fines that social media companies could face as a result of some of these hate speech incidents. So we're going to have to monitor this and see what happens. It's going to be a long, drawn-out story, I have no doubt, one that the governments and social media companies are going to be opposite sides of. Even though they'd all like to crack down on hate speech, I think they're both pointing the finger in the other direction, saying it's not our responsibility as a social media company, it's the people who post. The government has a different opinion. They say it's the social media companies, they're the ones who are hosting these users, and they're the ones that need to crack down on what they say.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A rare alert against North Korean cyber attacks. The Pentagon chief says the U.S. is not winning in Afghanistan. The Supreme Court gives Trump more time to file a travel ban brief. And President Trump clings to coal as worldwide demand plummets. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, an American college student held in North Korea for 17 months is finally home, but with a tragic twist. As his parents say, he's been in a coma for more than a year. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson confirmed Tuesday that 22-year-old Otto Warmbier was released from prison and being reunited with his family.
We continue our discussions with the North Korean regime regarding the release of the three other American citizens that have been detained. We have no comment on Mr. Warmbier's condition out of respect to him and the family.
State Department officials refused to comment on his health, citing department guidelines, but said the last time the U.S. had any access to Warmbier through the Swedish embassy was March of last year. Warmbier's parents described their son's release as a medical evacuation. Fred and Cindy Warmbier said they were told their son was given a sleeping pill shortly after his trial last month and that he never woke up. He arrived in the state of Ohio and was transferred to a hospital. North Korea had sentenced Warmbier, a student at the University of Virginia, to a 15-year prison term for attempting to steal a propaganda poster. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Senior Director Stephen Newper of the Korea Society in New York.
It is quite a development and a very sad one at that. I mean, some relief for the family in terms of the release of the son, but the fact that the reports indicate that he's been in a coma for over a year and that he is in need of emergency medical care is not a good sign. And so there will certainly be, beyond the human tragedy, repercussions in terms of demands for accountability, because this happened under North Korea's arcane and inhuman policy of detaining Americans. And there will be demands on Capitol Hill. I'm sure there will be demands in other parts of government. And certainly there will be demands among the general public as this is reported and as more details come out.
I'm not sure who made the first contact between the United States and North Korea, but obviously the North Korean officials knew that he was seriously ill a year ago.
Yeah, it did, and it's reflective of that opaque nature of communications, which don't exist on any good level, and the fact that the family appeared to have some knowledge but refrained from much comment until today. Clearly, they wanted their son out of harm's way, and they've had some comments about feeling that the last administration urged them to show restraint, and the new administration was a bit more active. But the human toll is very strong in this case, and it leaves the American government in a bit of a bind because you still have three Americans who are detained, and winning their release is now of critical importance as well.
Do you think the Warmbier case will improve their prospects for freedom?
Potentially. You know, we'll have to see what happens in terms of his state of health when he lands and what the situation is, what the prognosis is. There have been such varied reports. There was one report that he was dead. There are other reports that he may not emerge out of the coma. I don't think anyone knows the answer. There's a lot of speculation in the press, but until he's back out of harm's way in Ohio with his family, it seems we'll have to wait and see. Clearly, the U.S. government will be pushing to win the freedom of the other three individuals, and perhaps with the visit by the former NBA star Dennis Rodman, that may be designed to provide him with a reward to take home. Clearly, anything that can be done to get those three Americans out of harm's way and return them to the United States is of critical importance.
The broader issue of U.S.-North Korea tensions over its nuclear missile programs, do you see the Warmbier case as part of the broader picture?
It's certainly part of the broader picture in that the North Koreans see it as a check. They have a rather scant deck. Clearly, the nuclear capability and their missile tests are things that are of tremendous and highly visible importance. But the fact that they've detained these Americans is designed by them to show some leverage, to create some opportunity for eventual negotiation and to win some sort of reward, whether that's a high-level emissary who comes to retrieve them, whether in their minds there's a payoff of some sort. But, of course, it's an inhuman and illegal type of activity. It violates every international norm. It needlessly worries families involved. And, of course, as we're seeing now in the Otto Warmbier case, has real human tolls.
That's Korea Society's Stephen Norper. Meanwhile, former professional basketball star Dennis Rodman traveled Tuesday to North Korea on a trip he said he hopes will open a door between President Donald Trump and leaders in Pyongyang. Rodman previously traveled to North Korea in 2013, where he organized a basketball game that included other former NBA stars and sang happy birthday to Kim Jong-un, who he is reportedly a basketball fan. Concerns about the problems raised by fake news in the digital age is the topic being examined by a panel of experts at an event at the UN Human Rights Council. Fake news, propaganda, and disinformation has always existed. Thomas Hanochi, Australian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, said, "What sets this apart from years gone by is its rapid dissemination and global reach."
Propaganda and disinformation has always existed, but what has changed nowadays is the scale of it in our digital age, where every individual has access to the internet.
The panel's also examining the harmful impact fake news has on the credibility and independence of journalism, democratic values, and human rights. Eileen Donahoe, former U.S. ambassador to the Human Rights Council, says digital technology can be a force of good, but in the post-Brexit, post-U.S. presidential election world, it can also work in the opposite direction.
We now see that weaponization of information can be a very potent force in undermining democratic discourse and disrupting democratic processes.
Still, she says it has played a very positive role in facilitating the free flow of information and blossoming of freedom of expression globally. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24-7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at entertainment news. And joining me for that is Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Hi, Michelle. So, sounds like actress Jennifer Lawrence had a pretty harrowing experience with a plane that almost crashed.
Yes, Jennifer Lawrence was in a very scary situation over the weekend. She was flying. We're not sure where she was going exactly, but she was leaving her family in Kentucky and had to make an emergency landing in Buffalo, New York, because the engine of her private jet actually failed while she was in flight. And the pilot, as he was trying to make this emergency landing, had a second engine failure. So it was really, they had ambulances and emergency staff waiting at the tarmac for them to land. And it was really kind of a miracle that nobody was injured in this, because it sounds really scary when one engine goes and then the other one goes. She has not released a statement yet, but I know fans have been sending their good wishes and all of that to her. So it's great news that nobody was injured in all of this and that everybody got home safe.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And then let's turn to this just unbelievable success story of the Wonder Woman movie. It's really inspiring women across the U.S. and the star, boy, Gal Gadot, from the Israeli actress from out of nowhere, is now a huge hit in Israel and, of course, here in the United States.
Yes, she is inspiring women coast to coast. People are obsessed with her now. She actually came out and said that she was 5 months pregnant while she was filming Wonder Woman, which is amazing because she's doing all these incredible stunts. I believe she did most of them herself, and nobody knew that she was expecting. So she was able to keep that a secret. And then now with the success of Wonder Woman and all of the women, the female-only screenings and things that are happening here in the U.S., a lot of it is inspiring other women to raise money for charities and things like that. So it's really empowering right now. So great news for her.
And it's interesting, too, because she's also sort of inspiring women in another way regarding fashion.
Yes. So she really wants women, especially Hollywood women, to feel comfortable when they're walking the red carpet down to their shoes. I mean, she is saying that women should be able to wear flats when they want to wear them. And she's put a stop to high heels for herself. She thinks that every actress should be able to be comfortable on the red carpet and walk the red carpet in flat shoes.
I second that notion. Thanks so much, as always. Nicole Moschella with Rare.us. French DJ David Guetta and singer Justin Bieber have combined forces to release a new single that's shooting up the charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London talks about it with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Justin, who was discovered in 2008 on YouTube, put out his debut EP called My World in 2009. He became the first artist to have 7 songs make it onto the charts from his debut album. And in 2010, he put out My World, which brought him his first number one song, Baby. So for today, it's the latest song from Justin Bieber, and this song is called To You.
No limit in the sky that I won't fly for you. Tears in my eyes that I won't cry for you.
All right, Larry. Well, now, Justin Bieber, over the years, his image has changed, I guess you could say. He started out, he was like really, really clean cut, sort of this innocent young boy. And, you know, now he's got some tattoos. He's kind of a different image.
Well, it's a different image, but he's also a little older, more mature. You know, when we all discovered him, he needed his parents' permission for tattoos. Now he doesn't anymore, but Justin's had a, you know, as you say, an up and down ride. It was great to see him perform on stage at the One Love Manchester concert. You saw an emotional side. He broke down into tears, talked about religion, urged the crowd to love one another, and it really moved him. You could see he was very sincere when he was on stage in Manchester. And the very next day, he went and he joined a Manchester hockey team called the Storm on Monday, because he loves hockey, he's from Canada, and he skated with them, and then he donated his stick, and he autographed the jersey he wore, and they're going to auction those things off for charity to raise money for a charity that they're involved with in Manchester. But he's got some good sides to him and shows those good sides every once in a while, and unfortunately, every time he says, hey, I'm on the right track now, I'm going to do better, I've grown up, I'm going to improve, something comes up to kind of side rail him a little bit. But nonetheless, his career is doing great. He was just recently number one for a couple of weeks here in the U.S. and in the U.K. with a song that he was a part of called Despacito, the first Spanish song to hit number one since Macarena in 1996. And the song originally created by Louis Fonsi. Louis spoke with Rolling Stone magazine and said that he was a little bit reluctant to let an English-speaking person who doesn't speak Spanish sing on the song because it's in Spanish. But he said, well, you know, it's Justin Bieber. Let's give it a try. So it was a good decision. However, Justin, a couple weeks ago, was performing in concert, forgot the words to the song when he was performing his show, and substituted Despacito for the word burrito. And this past week, during a concert that he was performing in Stockholm, he said, I'm not going to sing Despacito because I've forgotten the words. Fans got upset. One hurled a water bottle at him.
Oh, no.
So they wanted to hear the song, but he admits to struggling with the lyrics in another language. So we're happy that he's back, and I'm sure his 88 million followers on social media are thrilled. He posted the video to the new song, To You, which, by the way, features a number of Victoria's Secret supermodels. So he was going for a different angle this time around. But it's a great song, To You. I love it. And his Purpose Tour continues through the rest of the summer. He'll end up in Tokyo, Japan with the last show September 24th.
Yeah, he just needs to remember to bring a copy of the lyrics with him.
That's right. And no one would fault him for a little cheat sheet. It isn't his language after all, so why not?
Okay. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
When it comes to you, don't be blind. Watch me speak.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt recently severed relations with Qatar over allegations of tolerating or supporting extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda's Syria branch. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the situation is troubling to the United States, the region, and to many people who are directly affected. As we combine efforts to defeat the military, financial, and ideological support of terrorists, said Mr. Tillerson, we expect to see progress in the Arab world toward greater political expression. The Gulf Cooperation Council offers member states the opportunity to engage in open dialogue. There should be no further escalation by the parties in the region, said Secretary Tillerson. We call on Qatar to be responsive to the concerns of its neighbors. Qatar has a history of supporting groups that have spanned the spectrum of political expression, from activism to violence. The Emir of Qatar has made progress in halting financial support and expelling terrorist elements from his country. But he must do more, and he must do it more quickly. The U.S. calls on Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt to ease the blockade against Qatar. There are already food shortages that can and should be addressed immediately. The blockade is also impairing U.S. and other international business activities in the region and has created a hardship on the people of Qatar and the people whose livelihoods depend on commerce with Qatar. The U.S. supports the Emir of Kuwait's efforts to bring about a peaceful resolution to this agreement and progress toward eliminating all forms of support for terrorism, military, financial, moral, or ideological. The Gulf Cooperation Council must emerge united and stronger to show the world its resolve in the fight against violence and terrorism. Our expectation, said Secretary Tillerson, is that these countries will immediately take steps to de-escalate the situation and put forth a good faith effort to resolve their grievances they have with each other.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is 4.